from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, earlier this week, New York Times executive editor Dean Baquet signaled a shift in the paper's approach to campaign coverage. "We have decided to be more direct in calling things out when a candidate actually lies," he said. And his comments came in the wake of Donald Trump's press conference, where the GOP candidate reversed course and said he now believes that President Barack Obama was born in the United States. For her part, Hillary Clinton has frustrated reporters with her lack of accessibility. We'll talk about how the mainstream media is struggling with and evolving in response to an unusual election cycle. Forum is ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The New York Times has begun using the word lie fairly often in its coverage of Donald Trump's presidential campaign claims. This comes after criticism that the press has been far too cautious in pointing out Trump's false statements. How fair has media coverage of the presidential campaign been? Has there been a double standard with different rules for the two major candidates? And what lies ahead for media coverage as we approach the three presidential debates? As Election Day nears, we cover media coverage of the candidates in this morning's opening Forum Hour, and we go first to Tom Rosenstiel, who is executive director of the American Press Institute and who has been with us a number of times through the years talking about journalistic ethics. He's also the author of a new novel called Shining City. Tom Rosenstiel, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Well, actually, I'd like you to hear a cut first. A morning edition this morning actually brought up the whole question of lies versus falsehoods, and that becomes almost a semantic question. But the New York Times now freely using the word lie. And let's hear what the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, has to say.
For me, the moment was the birther story, where he has repeated for years his belief that President Obama was not born in the United States. That's not an obfuscation. That's not an exaggeration. I think that was just demonstrably a lie, and I think that lie is not a word that newspapers use comfortably.
And certainly NPR has not used it comfortably. Some of you may have also followed the story about Scott Detrow on the black pastor story and people saying he should have called Trump a liar. And basically the NPR editor said, well, that's not an appropriate word to use. Have we crossed a line here, Tom? I mean, are we in different territory as far as especially mainstream media?
Well, I mean, Trump tests the limits of conventional journalism, but the industry has, you know, the profession has evolved a lot. I mean, an analogous situation in the eyes of many journalists might be Joseph McCarthy and some of the things that he said that they knew were either wrong or you know, purely speculative and unproven. And they struggled back in the 1950s when we were much closer to what people might call he said, she said journalism, and journalism was more stenographic than it is today. It is much more analytical and interpretive generally in every piece. But I think it's also important to note that not every story on a newscast online or in print is the same. There are analytical stories that are trying to contextualize the news. There are also stories that are simply what happened today, what was said, what was the exchange between two people. And you, as a journalist, have to decide how much do I need to contextualize this particular statement. So it's not as though every time there's a misstatement by Donald Trump that it would be characterized as a lie, that they would say he's a liar, which is pretty different than saying this statement is untrue. We have a whole realm of fact-checking now. There's PolitiFact and FactCheck.org. Many publications, including NPR, are engaged in fact-checking, where they will say this is untrue, and there are five Pinocchios in the Washington Post, or a pants on fire at PolitiFact. you're already pretty far down the road. The question of whether you want to use the word liar or misstatement or false statement on some level is semantic. And a lie, of course, in epistemological terms, means you knew it was false when you said it, and your motives were sort of mendacious in doing so.
But we're in, as you kind of intimated, we're in different territory now. I mean, Trump, for one thing, delegitimizes the media and doesn't seem to care and is playing by utterly different rules. He simply says they're wrong or they're lying or they're despicable or gets an attack on Megyn Kelly when she questions this speech that in rhetoric he's used about women, that sort of thing. I mean, it makes it very difficult for the press to call him out.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, this goes beyond sort of working the refs. It's almost like refusing to leave the box after a third strike has been called. Again, this isn't entirely new. It's a kind of a matter of degree. In 1992, George H. Walker Bush had bumper stickers made saying, "Annoy the media, reelect Bush." But that came pretty late in the election after he was clearly down in the polls. George Wallace used to call out the media in his rallies. In 1968, he would say, "Oh, look back there, and behind that rope, there is the media, the national media," and he would particularly point out individual reporters. There's Jack Nelson from the Los Angeles Times, but Wallace would kid reporters later about it. They kind of knew what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. They were being made foils. They felt uncomfortable about it, but there was a level of artifice to it. Here, I think there's just pure animus, and he has, you know, locked news organizations out of his rallies. It's a level of demonization that makes it extremely hard. I think the challenge for a news organization, I know one of the issues that NPR is reckoning with and others is if you go too far, if you go beyond all the traditional boundaries of trying to cover as an observer the events, but put yourself in the position of being essentially a participant in them, what are the implications for after the election? What do people think of you? Do they reset their expectations and allow you to be a referee again rather than a combatant? After the election's over, particularly if it's President Trump, who they're covering, or have you crossed a line that is difficult to cross back from?
Yeah, it gets into that kind of gray territory between what is factual and what is opinion, and it's vexing. I mean, for example, there's been a lot of finger pointing at Secretary Clinton for what was described as her reluctance to address health issues and her being somewhat by the standards of what was intimated, maybe concealing things about her health that she wasn't open about. And there have also been a lot of strong suggestions about her being a liar. I mean, some of this perhaps fomented by Donald Trump calling her lying Hillary and so forth. And so it becomes often a gray territory and a very difficult territory.
Yeah, now you're into philosophy you're sitting there on the news desk trying to make coverage decisions, and you're trying to assess what's the philosophical or epistemological nature of this deception versus that deception, or this evasion versus that evasion. Is it somehow, if Hillary didn't acknowledge that she was sick, is that worse than Donald Trump not acknowledging that he said something in the past? Is one lie more evil than another? These are extremely uncomfortable decisions for a news organization to make. They may not be qualified to make them, and certainly to make them, at the pace at which digital media occurs. So, you know, I think it's that's why NPR has decided, let's stick with language that is that keeps us in the role of an observer. You know, it's a little bit like in wartime, to what extent do you shred the Constitution to engage in a war to defend it? You know, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus in the Civil War and various other things. You know, you have to do that very, very carefully. And, you know, what is the existential threat to the country? Those are very tough decisions, and I'm not, you know, I'm not sure how comfortable we want to how comfortable we should be having news organizations make them. I mean, if you've got to, and I know Dean Baquet at the Times is doing this very, very carefully, and he's not doing it in every story. But there are consequences, particularly when you're being demonized by the political figures you're trying to cover.
And not only demonized, but Donald Trump has threatened to take away the license of the New York Times, for example, and the Washington Post. And, you know, there's been no response from Trump about detailed questions that were sent to him about Farenthold's work, about the $258,000 from the Trump Foundation to settle lawsuits for political profit. We've got dueling foundations stories here going in the press in a madcap way. Let me, we're talking to Tom Rosenstiel, who's executive director of the American Press Institute, but I want to bring Katrina Vandenhoevel into this. She's editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Welcome, Katrina. Good to have you back with us on the forum.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, The Nation has said that the coverage of Donald Trump amounts to, I'm using your phrase, your magazine's phrase, media malpractice. Why and what do you think of this apparent shift in a more overt critical coverage?
You know, let me step back. I mean, I think this has been a rewrite the rules election, and it's a rewrite rules in some ways thinking about the media. We've lived in a post-truth kind of media environment before. I don't usually cite Daniel Patrick Moynihan, but he used to say that you have a right to your own opinions, not to your own facts. When I talked about media malpractice, my larger point was just in an election, you want serious debates over serious issues. That's one. And I think there are different media in this country, Michael. I mean, I think, you know, there's your radio show, for example. There's the Washington Post's David Farenthold doing yeoman's work exposing Trump's phony philanthropy. There's The Nation. Cable TV television, where I believe most people still get their news, though they're getting a run for their money. That's where I see most of the media malpractice and the amount of kind of lavish time they've given to Donald Trump and the fact that they've treated him as a kind of profit center, not a news story too often. The endless coverage wall-to-wall of rallies last year. And I think this moment last week was a tipping point for some in the media. Margaret Sullivan in the Washington Post wrote about this birther press conference Trump held last Friday, that it's time for TV news to stop playing the stooge for Donald Trump. So I think you need to think of different media, how the Trump spectacle has played on television and cable, and the larger role of the media, Michael. I mean, it seems to me it's to hold lawmakers and other powerful interests accountable for their words and actions. I do believe in that, that there's an adversarial accountability role that has been dropped in too much of particularly cable TV and television coverage. And we saw it in that commander-in-chief forum a week or so ago, I'll stop, where you had, you know, Matt Lauer spending more time on certain issues, which I would argue weren't priority, weren't the issues of our time. You didn't hear a word about the nuclear peril, the refugee crisis, or global warming. So that's my concern about where we are as in the media.
Well, you've stated it, I think, quite correctly about different brands of maybe even partisanship or coverage with all of what is out there in the media. But, you know, you hear certainly that hear a lot from more of the liberal progressive press that Trump's getting a pass and the press is much too, or certainly cable, sensitive to, I'm thinking about MSNBC and stations like that, much too sensitive to conservatives, so they're overcompensating. But then you hear the obvious sort of things on the other, we're not too tough enough on Hillary Clinton and not pressing her enough in terms of liberal bias.
You know, I don't really see this as liberal conservative bias. I really don't. I mean, The Nation in 1996 did a special issue on the national entertainment state, and it focused, again, largely on TV at that time. But these are profit centers. I mean, there's a reason that a Jimmy Fallon is doing something different, or even a Matt Lauer, than a David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post. So I think that one of the, you know, journalism's responsibility is to, as I said, to hold candidates accountable. And that means holding Hillary Clinton accountable. But I do think journalists need to ask whether they've created a narrative about Clinton that paints her as less trustworthy than Trump, even though the factual evidence is overwhelming that he lies far more than she does. And I think the issue of calling out a lie is important. Why are we tiptoeing around? I think it does a disservice. We live in the age of distrust of political, economic, financial, and media elites who brought us, thank you, you know, the war in Iraq, the Great Recession of 2008, growing inequality. And I think people out there want to hear some straight talk. And, you know, that's where I think the media has kind of tiptoed around with Trump, not just TV, but even print.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Fallon. I'm just struck by that because a lot of people were terribly critical of him for messing with Trump's hair and all that.
But they should be. But they should also understand what I said, Michael, which is they're different media. You're not going to get from a guy who's running late night, hosting a late night TV show, which is what it is. And let us also admit, it is a profit center for that network. You're not going to get tough adversarial questions. Stephen Colbert may be different for all kinds of reasons we can talk about, but I think we're losing sight, and it's, you know, I come back to it, it's not one big media. And I think that's where, you know, we need to press hard and hold accountable those running these networks who have admitted, as you know, that, you know, it may not be good for the country, but it's damn good for this or that network. The money's rolling in. And if that's how we're doing news coverage, and I don't mean to sound, you know, old-fashioned, but public interest issues, debates, what an informed citizenry needs to make decisions, you know, I think these are serious questions that we need to think about, because Trump has exposed a lot in this country. In many ways, he's the symptom, not the cause of our disorder. And I think the media has been exposed in different ways for not being able to hold accountable in ways it needs to.
We're talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. We're going to speak shortly with James Toronto, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. But let me cut to something I think quite important here with you, Katrina, and that is when Trump is asked, for example, about his foundation, he brings up criticism of the Clinton Foundation. I was talking before somewhat wistfully about dueling foundations, but how should the media handle that?
I think the media should dig into the Clinton Foundation. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think, again, the danger of falling into the liberal conservative media traps. If you have two general election candidates, there should be investigation, serious investigation. But I think there's been more accountability. There's been more digging. I remember some major series in the New York Times more than a year ago on the Clinton Foundation and its ties to Russia and uranium, for example. I do think when the media went berserk about Trump and his ties, we still don't know because he won't release his tax returns, which must be asked at every point, and the media should hold him accountable for that. But, you know, the Clinton Foundation has had ties to consultants who did business with Russia or uranium moguls in Russia. Ukrainian oligarchs gave money to the Clinton Foundation. I think that's fair game. What I think is wrong, Michael, is when you have a commander-in-chief, and, you know, I hate that it was called that. It should be like, how do we bring peace to this world forum? You know, Matt Lauer spent, I think it was a third, tell me I'm wrong, of his time, or the forum's time, grilling Hillary Clinton about her emails. That is an appropriate question, but that amount of time, as I said, obliterated the possibility of asking what I would argue are more serious questions as to who is fit to be commander-in-chief. I do think underlying a lot of this is not left-right. It's about the obliteration of the line between what is news and entertainment. And I think that is something we need to focus hard on. And Donald Trump, as a flamboyant showman who has participated, run, hosted reality shows, knows full well the media's weaknesses and has played them.
All right.
And I think, Yeah.
Yeah. No, Katrina, thank you so much. It's always good to have you here.
Thank
Katrina,
you very much, Michael.
Katrina Van Hoevel, again, is editor and publisher of Nation magazine. I want to go right to James Taranto, though, who is a columnist with the Wall Street Journal. Good to have you aboard here, James Taranto. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And you've, by contrast to what we heard from Katrina Van Hoevel, you've called the media's new willingness to call out Trump's falsehoods a media surrender. What do you mean by that?
Well, I wouldn't call it, I would disagree with the characterization calling out Trump's falsehoods. Obviously, if Trump says something that's false, it's proper for the media to point out, for news reporters to point out what the true facts are. But where I have a problem is when they start using terms like lie in news stories, and this is what happened after the birther thing. Just about every major news organization in the country in news stories said, Donald Trump finally admitted that he was lying about President Obama's birthplace, but then he embraced another lie, which was that Mrs. Clinton started the birther thing. Now, let's take a couple of contrasting examples. When James Comey came out with his findings on the Hillary Clinton email scandal in July, one could have said that James Comey showed that Hillary Clinton had been lying about any number of things involving the email scandals. But that's not how the news reporters covered it, and I think appropriately so. They set forward the facts. They used neutral language. Another example, when Obamacare, the promise of if you like your plan, you can keep your plan, when that turned out to be a falsehood, my newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, reported on its news pages that the people in the Obama administration who had been putting together Obamacare knew full well that that wasn't the case. Now, I'm an opinion columnist, so I wrote that it was a lie, but the news reporters did not write that it was a lie. They just reported the facts and let the readers make up their own minds. So it's a question of how it's appropriate for news reporters to cover the news. I agree with Katrina. You're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. But news reporters are supposed to keep their opinions to themselves.
And you actually have pointed out that what you see as media open hostility against Trump may actually be helping Secretary Clinton's campaign?
I think that it may actually help Trump's campaign. I mean, remember, the news media are there was just our newspaper had a poll yesterday, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, that found the news media actually have a lower approval rating than Trump, who in turn has a lower approval rating than Mrs. Clinton. But all three of them are underwater. Gallup recently found that Americans' trust in the news media is at an all-time low. So I suspect readers are going to discount for this, and I'm not sure that it helps Mrs. Clinton at all. Although I think that is the objective, and has been made clear to be the objective in some cases. The New York Times recently ran a column by its media columnist Jim Rutenberg, calling for a suspension of the practice.
I'm sorry, James, can you stay with us? Because we're coming up on a break here, and I also misspoke. I meant to say actually may help the Trump campaign. I said help the Clinton campaign.
Right.
I want to give our listeners an opportunity, though, to join this program. And, in fact, let me do that now. You can, by our toll-free number, call us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call if you have something you'd like to say or ask. Again, join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Election day nearing, media coverage of presidential candidates under scrutiny. That's really what we're looking at this hour and talking a good deal about journalistic ethics. In fact, Tom Rosenstiel is with us on the line. He's executive director of the American Press Institute. We spoke earlier with Katrina Van Den Hoevel of The Nation, editor and publisher of The Nation, and James Taranto is online with us now, columnist of The Wall Street Journal. You can, of course, add your voice, and we invite you to do that. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. James Ferrano, I want to go back to you and have you finish your thought, but In one of your columns, you were talking about talking to Maureen Dowd, an opinion columnist, not necessarily someone we would expect facts from, and there's the line of demarcation, but also an interview with Chuck Todd.
I'm sorry, I have to correct you on that. We do expect facts from opinion columnists. We don't expect opinions from news reporters.
All right. Thank you for that. I didn't mean to suggest that columnists weren't factual. I meant to say that there's a different expectation. There's more often opinions that can be, in fact, separated from facts or supported by facts. But I'm also prompted to reference what you referenced was an interview with Chuck Todd. Maureen Dowd said there are a lot of people who won't read anything she writes about Trump. So this suggests that a lot of people certainly are giving Hillary Clinton a pass, but a lot of people are giving Donald Trump a pass. And what is a journalist supposed to do in the wake of that kind of an attitude, which is fairly strong in this country?
Well, the people who she was referring to who wouldn't read anything she writes about Trump are not Trump's people, who I suspect are, for the most part, not New York Times readers. She was talking about people who support Mrs. Clinton. Maureen has done a number of interviews with Trump and has actually been less unsympathetic to him than most New York Times columnists. So she's talking about people in that sort of Upper West Side bubble that the Times actually had a wonderful news story about, people who just can't possibly believe that that Trump is going to win. What journalists should do, I think they should redouble their efforts. I mean, if we're talking about news reporters, redouble their efforts to practice their craft according to the way it's been practiced. I think, you know, you were talking in the earlier segment about Mr. Farenthold at the Washington Post doing investigative work on Trump's foundation and his charitable giving. I think that's the sort of thing that journalists ought to be doing. That's that's important work, and they should be doing that with Mrs. Clinton as well.
They should also, according to you, be doing fact checking, but you say it's often deceptive. It's often not applied equally. Can you talk about that?
Well, the whole fact check genre is a problem, because really what a fact check is, and I'm talking about these pieces by groups like PolitiFact and factcheck.org that build themselves as fact checks, they're actually really opinion pieces. They take some assertion from usually a politician, or although sometimes it's a pundit or somebody else, and they then evaluate the facts, and then at the end there is a statement of opinion, and sometimes they do it in cutesy ways like they say pants on fire, or the Washington Post gives out Pinocchios to statements that its fact checkers deem false. So there's the whole fact checking genre is a confusion between opinion and facts. And then PolitiFact starts putting out these bogus statistics, like Mrs. Clinton's statements were rated truthful more than Trump's statements were rated truthful. Well, there are all kinds of methodological problems with that, given the subjectivity of the fact-check process itself and of the selection of what statements you're going to check. I mean, the whole thing is just nonsense, and it doesn't bolster one's confidence in the media's ability to sort out the facts. I should say some good work is done under the rubric of fact-checking, just as some very good journalistic work is done under the rubric of open opinion journalism.
James Serrano, columnist with the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And we are going to be joined in just a moment by Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor on the media from NPR. We're also going to take your calls, but I want to go to some comments here, because James Serrano was just talking about Politico, and Paul, a listener, writes, Politico does a great job of fact-checking claims and classifying their veracity from true to pants on fire. I follow this campaign closely, and I'm puzzled why NPR and other reputable news organizations that serve a large percentage of the populace do not report Politico's reporting more regularly. And Sean writes, I'm not a Trump supporter, but it's clear the New York Times and other newspapers have given Clinton a free pass while submitting article after article against Trump. The latest hullabaloo was over that Skittles meme, but no one mentioned that they were just copying a similar M&M's meme that feminists made in 2014 to state that men were dangerous. Let's be clear. The New York Times will not call out any Hillary Clinton's lies or bad policies, and it's because of it that people will be more drawn to the alt-right news and vote for Trump. And John writes, I would not call Trump a liar. He's actually a BSer. That is someone who speaks without any concern for truth or falsehood of what he says. Paul says, please, please talk about the double standards. If Clinton said she would release details about her health and instead went on Dr. Oz with a very short summary, she'd be pilloried as not transparent. Trump's failure to follow through causes hardly a ripple. Or if she didn't release taxes, or if her foundation was sleazy, it would be a huge big deal. Somehow he gets a pass. And Ben says, does it make any difference that it's the New York Times versus a different paper that is calling him a liar? New York Times has been perceived to have a pro-Clinton bias. We'll take more of your emails and we'll take your calls. But first, I want to go to Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media from NPR. It airs, by the way, on KQED Public Radio, Sundays at 2 p.m. Brooke, glad to have you with us. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, let me begin by asking you about fact-checking and your take on that. What can be done to do better fact-checking? And is it, like James Toronto said, something that really raises some serious questions?
Look, it's an art. It's not a science. And PolitiFact and many others struggle mightily to be even-handed in how they do it. He doesn't like the way it turns out, so he says it's all biased. He questions the methodology. It's like anything else. You question the methodology of a poll that you don't like, but some polls are demonstrably better than others. Doing fact-checking is better than not doing it, and that's a simple fact, and it is good as it is possible to make it. That doesn't mean it doesn't have flaws.
And what's your feeling about calling Trump a liar on the birther issue, and not only on the birther issue itself, but also on his following that up with saying it came from Hillary Clinton, and I suppose... Well, now,
I know
you're laughing, Brooke, but the irony of that is those Trump defenders say that, and they do have, I guess, some support for this, that Sid Blumenthal put this out when Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama, and he has been described as her consigliere. So it may be a prevarication or it may not be a prevarication, depending on how you see it.
You know, whatever happened in the previous campaign, it was precipitously dropped, whereas you could fill entire phone books with references to Obama's supposed dubious birthplace just by following Trump and Fox News and generally the right. What might have been a cheap and quickly dispatched with campaign tactic early on became a kind of a dog whistle for a black president's inauthenticity, his secret silent alliances that we don't know about. At the same time, we all knew from things that were said on Fox that he was really secretly a Muslim and all of that. They were all part of a piece. He was part of the other. And an important part of the other, of course, is not being an American because it completely delegitimizes you. So whether or not, I don't know where it began. Let me just say for the purposes of this conversation, Sid Blumenthal did it. It didn't go anywhere on the right. It didn't catch fire. It was a perfect present wrapped up for holiday giving to the right, and that is where the damage was done.
I'm wondering too about your partner Bob Gardfield called this era post-truth politics. Remember when we were talking after Barack Obama was elected about being a post-racial society? Are we in the kind of post-truth mode here?
Well, Bob and I are definitely not the Bobbsey twins. We have lots of disagreements. And my feeling is that election time is always a post-truth time, and that it isn't a qualitative difference. It's a quantitative difference. We in the media are so swamped with untruths, such extreme untruths, that they can't keep track of them all. So things that would have been major scandals a long time ago, obfuscations, withholding of information, and outright whoppers, demonstrable whoppers, they get a couple of mentions on a couple of news cycles, and they don't seem to do any damage to Donald Trump. Now, I think that PolitiFact was doing the best it could when it declared that Hillary Clinton was a garden variety liar in among politicians. She lied the average amount that politicians lie. That's what creates the post-truth era every major election cycle every 4 years. But when you get somebody who's lies are torrential. It breaks the rules and throws the media into disarray, which is where we are now.
Yeah, well, in fact, I should mention on the media has done a fairly close scrutiny of Secretary Clinton and has certainly brought to light a whole history there of, well, concealment, I suppose you could call it, or hedging the truth or falsehoods or et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'd append one other statement to that, which is simply the fact that those who are leading the pack usually get the most scrutiny. But now we have kind of a neck-to-neck race. And I should mention that Brooke Gladstone, again, is host and managing editor of On the Media, and Tom Rosensteel is still with us. And I want to bring our callers into this, so let's go to you. Cynthia. Good morning, Cynthia.
Hi, good morning. My question is for your guest, what they think about this election cycle and when stories did emerge in the media. What I was curious about was what I found myself doing was, and I'm a Clinton supporter, I should say, up front, was going to places like John Oliver and Trevor Noah in the evenings to get some snippet of an investigative reporting story on Trump. And that was early on in the election cycle. And I wonder if the guest could speak to whether or not they think that Trump got a pass in the first several months because he was so popular and perhaps lucrative.
Cynthia, excuse me, you're raising, I think, a very important question. I'll go to Tom Rosensteel on this. There's been, Tom, the argument advanced that not only in the debates were Trump's opponents, not striking back as strongly as they could because they didn't take him that seriously, but that certainly journalists put not necessarily kid gloves on him, but didn't go after him as strongly as they could have because they didn't take him seriously enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think you had two things happening there. Trump had momentum, so other candidates in the Republican side actually thought he would fade, and so they wanted to assimilate his supporters and become, the champion of his supporters and their own. They all assumed that was going to happen, so no one wanted to take him on. Plus, he's a talented pugilist. On the press side, as you say, Michael, he was viewed as an entertainment. He was exploited for ratings, and he wasn't scrutinized as hard as he could have been during that phase. Also, no candidates are scrutinized at that level when there's 12 candidates in the race. You know, your investigative teams are sort of not in full flower at that point. One other point that I want to make that goes to the point that Brooke made about speed and the velocity of this. The press, in its and this is the flaw with the earlier guest's idea that journalists should simply report facts and do nothing more. The traditional notion of the press was that it was the gatekeeper deciding what the public should hear and what it should not hear. Now, in the digital age of social media, the press is no longer deciding what we should know. They are annotating, to a large degree, what we've already heard through social flow, through the tweets of the candidates directly, and all the other streams that we have, which is why your caller is thinking at the end of the day, I need some context here, something that helps me make sense of the things I've been hearing all day long. So the role of the press has evolved simply because people expect other things from us, and it's not simply enough to know what did the mayor say at the garden party this morning.
And I want to bring another caller on. Nancy joins us from Dover, Kentucky. Nancy, welcome. You're on the air.
My comment kind of echoes what you were about annotating. I feel that the mainstream press has become a kind of echo chamber. For example, they never mention Hillary Clinton without saying the word untrustworthiness. And they just sort of, latch on to phrases that are repeated across media. So I think they would gain a lot more respect if they did. They don't have to call people liars, but they can say, there's some spinning here, which we expect from politicians. But we would like a little bit more clarity and reflection and depth in news reporting. And we're just kind of getting a rehash and annotating of what the latest, you know, kind of case on this particular candidate is.
Well, Nancy, I thank you for that call. And Brooke Lassen, let me go to you on that, because I alluded to the fact earlier that on the media has been consciously making listeners aware that going all the way back to cattle futures and the like, Hillary Clinton behaved like she had a good deal to hide and seemed to continue to do that, particularly with her health more recently. But I want to ask you directly, about this narrative. It is one of her being less trustworthy, and it's one that seems almost ubiquitous in the media.
Yeah. First of all, I want to completely agree with Tom that annotation, that is to say contextualizing, bringing in some institutional history and memory, is what is left for us to do if we have any expertise, because reporting from the field can be pretty much done by anybody now. Getting to your
plus,
point
excuse
about
me, what kind of an onus does this put on, you know, on people out there who want to learn what is going on, want light to be shed, and want enlightenment? That's just it.
That's what I'm saying. Annotation means that you are footnoting the basic events with all the background that they need, and even in this digital age, if I may go further than Tom would here, it's kind of changed the culture, which is why the New York Times can say, Trump said this, not true, also this, also not true, whereas the not true, not true stuff used to be spun off into a little box labeled analysis or an opinion somewhere deeper into the paper. Now there is an effort, finally, to put those things closer together where they can be more useful to the news consumer. Do you want me to go to the narrative question now?
Yes, please.
Okay, because the thing about a political narrative, a political frame, is that is something that happens again every election cycle. Look back. George W. Bush was the frat boy, and Kerry was the effete Francophile, and of course Hillary back then, the scheming emasculator. Gore was a mendacious prig. Obama was the savior. You know, all of those different frames, they are extremely hard to break because they are little boxes that reporters who have to cover every election cycle, once they've decided on it, and I know this is a terrible, terrible libel to cast on my colleagues in the field, but I noticed over the years there's a great resistance to changing those frames once you've set on them. It makes the job, it makes it easier to convey things to the public because it's all pre-contextualized. And in fact, when the reporters do have to change the frames, my favorite case is John McCain, who was always the maverick. The media always liked him a lot. He was considered the media darling. You know, when he began his campaign in 2000, he called Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance, said that the NRA didn't do anything for the Republican Party, said that the pro-life plank in the GOP should be changed to allow for rape and incest or to save the life of the mother, reversed all those positions. And I think that the press, the reporters that followed him around, couldn't help but feel a certain betrayal. You have undermined our narrative about you, and now we are going to change it in spades.
You're not our kind of maverick.
Well, you're not a maverick at all anymore. As John Stewart said to him, you've taken the, you've gotten on the bus to, what did he call it? Looney Town or something like that. But your listener is absolutely right. That is the frame that's used for Hillary. Hillary is slammed with it relentlessly, but it's not unprecedented for this to happen to every candidate at some point over the course of a presidential campaign.
And again, Brooke Gladstone is host and managing editor of On the Media from NPR. It airs on this radio station, KQED Public Radio, Sundays at 2 p.m. Here's Paul, who writes, it's ironic to talk about Trump's candidacy as being something unusual or something that the media can't get a handle on because the media coverage created Trump's candidacy. He was too good of a sideshow to not get coverage. They relentlessly covered him, way past any point of responsibility or journalistic integrity. What do you say to that, Tom Rosenstiel?
Well, I mean, that's, I would give that a half true in my political fact checking on it. You know, one of the things that Trump understood, and this was not a creation of the press, was anger from a certain cohort of the American public. Anger about globalization, anger about the loss of manufacturing. In many ways, his critique of what's wrong with America was pretty close to Bernie Sanders, and his prescriptions about what to do about it are pretty different. That was not a media creation, and the traction that he got in the polls was not a media creation. The, you know, the media here did what it often does, and not at its, and it's not, you know, it's not living up to its responsibility. It reinforced the phenomena that it was observing. It enabled Trump and accelerated something that he was picking up on. And one thing that Trump has understood better than other candidates, including Clinton, is how to create your own narrative through use of social media, his use of Twitter and other things. And the media are reacting to that. So, you know, I don't think they have clean hands in the early days of the Trump campaign. But, you know, the media are only now, they are a diminished influence in our lives. If you're talking about journalistic content that's been created by inside newsrooms, there's so much other content that people are reacting to. Journalism has always been the conversation of citizens, but there's a lot more to that conversation now than journalism.
All right, forgive me, Tom. I have to come in here and remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, and we're talking to Tom Rosenstiel and Brooke Gladstone, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny, and we'll go to more of your calls. Let me get a caller in from San Diego. John, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just noticed I drove from Coronado, San Diego, up to Central Coast, and I noticed it before I left even, that I think that the people are speaking out very quietly and very deliberately by not putting political signs in their front yard. I have never seen a vote for Hillary or a vote for Trump. So what is that saying, and why doesn't the media address that? Because that is, to me, one of the most obvious things that shows the divide between what's going on. And I live in Coronado, and it's staunchly Republican. And even the people that are, you know, running around and getting their Bush signs up, there's not one. I never saw one in any way.
Well, it's an interesting observation, John, and I thank you for it. I'm not sure we can... what we can deduce from that at this point, but
I can say simply that the media, well, the media have covered it, not in terms of counting lawn signs, but in talking directly from the polls, which media love, about the unfavorables of both of these candidates, the lack of passion, the number of people who. Like the candidates, really, really rivals the number that simply can't stand them. And then there are people who just pick the lesser of two evils. These aren't people who are going to be planting signs on their lawn. So,
well, even if that's 68% that distrust or dislike the candidates, there's still about a quarter of them who are strongly behind one candidate or the other. So you would think that there would at least be some lawn signs. He drove all the way up from San Diego and didn't see a lawn sign. But I'm also wondering, I'm looking at another listener response here that dovetails a bit. And this is something a bit more weighty, to be sure. And let me go to you on this, Brooke. This is a listener who writes, there is almost zero coverage of policy this year, including on NPR. It's only the horse race. Yet policy is what the candidates will do as president. The media has become glorified blogs.
Well, that is a hearty perennial during every election cycle, and I have seen so many of them, and I have made the exact same criticism myself. The horse race is much, much easier to cover. The horse race is also more exciting. And in the case of, and if you want that kind of balance that people think we want, which is really often expressed as a kind of fairness bias, giving equal time to two unequal sides, doesn't really inform the public that well. But you've got, you know, almost no policy from one candidate and maybe an overabundance of policy, or at least she's accused of that, from the other candidate. So, you know, Hillary just this week put an editorial in the New York Times about using, you know, earned income, low cost housing credits to help prevent evictions. You know, is that going to have people tuning in droves? Why is there always an issue gap every single election cycle? I can only say that this sort of circles back to the fact that media, all of them, and they are not, it is not a unitary institution, but it's many, many institutions, are businesses. And if people don't express interest by tuning in to it or, you know, supporting it, then it's not going to be there.
Well, we're certainly going to see probably a good deal of reference to policy in the debate that's coming up on Monday on Hillary Clinton's part, because she is kind of a policy wonk and she wants to show Trump wanting in that vein, so to speak. But I'm reading a comment here from a listener named Lucia. Says, you think it'd be helpful and possible to do some fact-checking in real time during the debates? In my opinion, supporters of both candidates watch debates while articles about the level of accuracy or lack thereof after the debate are primarily read by opponents of a candidate. If some fact-checks were done in real time, I believe it'd be a level playing field. Is that possible? Quick response, Tom Rosenfeld, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, and the fact-checking community actually has set up real-time fact-checking, and you'll see some of it during the campaign, and you'll see it in social in particular.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Rosenstiel, again, is executive director of American Press Institute, has a novel out called Shining City. Brooke Gladstone is host and managing editor of On the Media from NPR, which you can hear on KQED on Sundays at 2 p.m. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, senior editor Dan Zoll, and executive producer Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.